coronation of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II on the 2nd of June, 1953. The magic of the monarchy at its most potent. One of the curious political facts of the Western world that the monarchy as an institution has survived only in those countries which are the most stable and liberal of the democracies. And in no country is this paradox more striking than in Britain. Republicanism as a movement is dead. Even the various attempts to democratize the monarchy have never made much headway. The British want the pomp and ceremony, the majesty, if you like. They want their royal family to ride in golden coaches, not on bicycles. They want them both splendidly human and splendidly remote, a true family at the heart of the nation's affairs. So the British monarchy has survived, basically unaltered, the age of the common man and the arrival of those powerful forces, radio and television. Indeed, it was soon clear that the monarchy knew how to use these new instruments effectively, as we can hear in this first ever Christmas broadcast by King George V in 1932.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas day to speak to all my peoples throughout the empire. I take it as a good omen that wireless should have reached its present perfection at a time when the empire has been linked in closer union. For it offers us immense possibilities to make that union closer still. I speak now from my home and from my heart to you all. To men and women so cut off by the snows, the desert, or the sea, that only voices out of the air can reach them.
But this was not, of course, the first broadcast ever made by a British monarch. That happened in 1924, when King George V opened the British Empire Exhibition at Wembley.
I declare the British Empire Exhibition open, and I pray that by the blessing of God, it may contribute to the unity and prosperity of all my people and to the peace and well-being of the world.
From those days of rather indifferent sound, the new medium of radio swiftly developed both technically and as a means of entertainment, until by the 30s it was very much part of the life of the nation.
This is the national programme. Now we're going to take you over to Wimbledon for a running commentary on the All English Championship by Colonel Brand.
In the church cantatas of Bach, there exists a superb treasure of music which is practically unknown to the English public.
Now to turn to something thoroughly English. Here is a fine record of the Yeomen of England, sung by Peter Dawson.
Now here is Marion Cran, who is going to give you another of her garden talks.
And of course, the programmes of the BBC also reflected the grimmer realities of the economic situation. Growing unemployment, the monetary crisis. Listeners heard King George V open the World Economic Conference in London in 1933.
It is with a feeling of deep responsibility that I welcome you to this country. I believe this to be the first time in history that any sovereign has presided at the opening of a conference of all the nations of the world. All nations are suffering from a common ill. This is shown only too clearly by the rise in the figures of unemployment. The meaning of these figures in terms of human suffering has been my constant concern in recent years, as it has been the concern of every one of you here today, upon whom the responsibility of government has rested.
From the royal broadcasts of the early 30s, it is quite obvious that the sufferings caused by the Depression were a constant concern to the King and to his eldest son, Edward, Prince of Wales. Even, for example, at the launching by the Queen of the great liner named after her, the Queen Mary, the King returns to the same subject.
As a sailor, I have deep pleasure in coming here today to watch the launching by the Queen of this great and beautiful ship. For 3 years, her uncompleted hull has lain in silence on the stops. We grieve for what the suspension meant to thousands of our people. We rejoice that with the help of my government, it has been possible to lift that cloud and to complete this ship. May her life among great waters spread friendship among the nations.
I am happy to name this ship the Queen Mary. I wish success to her and to all to save in her.
At about the same time, the Prince of Wales, by now an experienced broadcaster, was speaking on the need for more voluntary services to help keep up the morale of the unemployed.
I am glad to tell you that today there are over 2,000 active voluntary schemes in existence all over the country, doing really valuable work in helping countless men and women who are unemployed to find something useful to do in the long empty hours of their unoccupied leisure, enabling them to learn for the first time the satisfaction of discovering all kinds of unexpected talents and new interests.
But the Prince of Wales was not content merely to make speeches about voluntary services. He knew that drastic remedies were needed to solve the problem of unemployment. After all, like everyone else, he could see the unemployed begging. He might even have heard these unemployed Welsh miners singing in the streets of London. The Prince insisted on visiting the depressed areas to see the problem at first hand. Years later, as the Duke of Windsor, in speaking from his home in France, he remembered the difficulties he sometimes got into because of this insistence.
I had a trip organized to go and visit some of the depressed areas. I went to Wales and different parts of Britain, and this one I think was up in the north, Northumberland. And when Stanley Baldwin got to hear of this trip, he called me to the House of Commons and said he'd like to talk to me about it. And he said, why are you going to going up there. Got any lot of other important things to do? So I said, no, Mr. Baldwin. I said, I think that it is very important to see how we can give these people employment. Some of them have been out for 10 years. We try and help them in their, give them something in the long leisure time that they have. Now, Mr. Baldwin was suddenly became conscious of the fact that he and his government had actually done very little to alleviate the plight of the unemployed. So he said, who suggested that you should go? I said, as a matter of fact, I'm going under the auspices of Sir Alexander Leith, who was chairman of the Conservative Association in Northumberland. Oh, he said, wonderful man, great friend of mine. I'm delighted, and I do hope that you will have a good trip. When I left the Prime Minister, he was Prime Minister at that time, I thought to myself that he was beginning to drag me in to politics a little too far. And as we all know, politics is the one thing that the royal family has to avoid, even however much they might like to express their opinions.
There were, however, a few cheerful interludes in the midst of the general gloom.
This is London. The following was published in the London Gazette of the 5th of October. At the court of Buckingham Palace, His Majesty was this day pleased to declare his consent to a contract of matrimony between his most dearly beloved son, His Royal Highness Prince George Edward Alexander Edmund, Knight of the Garter, Knight Grand Cross of St. Michael and St. George, Knight Grand Commander of the Victorian Order, and Her Royal Highness Princess Marina, daughter of His Royal Highness Prince Nicholas of Greece, and of Her Royal and Imperial Highness Princess Nicholas, which consent His Majesty has caused to be signified under the Great Seal and be entered in the books of the Privy Council.
And 8 weeks later, at that royal wedding in 1934, the first great royal family occasion to be broadcast, the then Duke of Kent chose this ancient prayer to be included in his marriage service, just as his great-niece, Princess Anne, did for her wedding 39 years later. And in the following year, to mark the 25th anniversary of his reign, the colourful pageantry and nostalgia of the celebrations of King George V's Silver Jubilee.
Thank you. close of this memorable day, I must speak to my people everywhere. Yet, how can I express what is in my heart? As I pass, as I pass this morning through cheering multitudes to and from St. Paul's Cathedral, as I thought there of all that these 25 years have brought to me and to my country and my empire, how could I fail to be most deeply moved? Words cannot express my thoughts and feelings. I can only say to you, my very dear people, that the Queen and I thank you from the depths of our hearts for all the loyalty and, may I say, the love with which this day and always you have surrounded us.
At the end of that same year, 1935, the King made his last Christmas broadcast. The last time, in fact, that his voice was heard on the air.
As I close, I send you all, and not least to the children who may be listening to me, my truest Christmas wishes, and those, my dear wife, my children, and grandchildren who are with me today. I add a heartfelt prayer that wherever you are, God may bless and keep you always.
And less than a month later, we heard this most moving announcement.
This is London. Following bulletin was issued at 9:25. The King's life is moving peacefully towards its close. Signed, Frederick Willans, Stanley Hewitt, Dawson of Penn.
Whereas it hath pleased Almighty God to call to his mercy our late sovereign lord, King George V, of blessed and glorious memory, by whose decease the imperial crown of Great Britain, Ireland, and all other his late majesty's dominions is solely and rightfully come to the high and mighty Prince Edward Albert Christian George Andrew Patrick David, we therefore do now hereby with one voice and consent of tongue and heart publish and proclaim that the high and mighty Prince Edward Albert Christian George Andrew Patrick David is now, by the death of our late sovereign of happy memory,
become our only lawful and rightful liege lord, Edward VIII.
And 7 days after the proclamation of the new king came the funeral of the old king.
The coffin halts before the door. The king stands saluting at the bottom of the steps, ready to lead the procession into the chapel. The state landau, drawn by the greys, draws up. Her Majesty, Queen Mary, dismounts and mounts the steps. Once more, the coffin moves forward. The archbishops of Canterbury and York wait to receive it. And there, in that ancient and historic chapel, the congregation waits. A coffin moves within, disappears from sight, and followed by the thoughts and homage of the world, so a great king passes to his rest.
King Edward VIII's reign lasted just over 10 months and was to end with a farewell speech broadcast from Windsor Castle, which has already taken its place as one of the most famous statements in the history of the British people.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I have never wanted to withhold anything, but until now, it has not been constitutionally possible for me to speak. A few hours ago, I discharged my last duty as King and Emperor. And now that I have been succeeded by my brother, the Duke of York, my first words must be to declare my allegiance to him. This I do with all my heart. You all know the reasons which have impelled me to renounce the throne. But I want you to understand that in making up my mind, I did not forget the country or the empire, which, as Prince of Wales and lately as King, I have for 25 years tried to serve. But you must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do, without the help and support of the woman I love. And I want you to know that the decision I have made has been mine and mine alone. And now we all have a new king. I wish him and you, his people, happiness and prosperity with all my heart. God bless you all. God save the King.